The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Josh Pick is the chief investment advisor with Aptus Wealth Management, a state-registered investment advisory firm. This program is sponsored by Aptus Wealth Management. Exposure to ideas and financial vehicles discussed should not be considered investment advice or recommendation to buy or sell financial vehicle. This information should not be considered tax or legal advice. Individuals should consult with professionals to see if any ideas expressed would fit their specific situation. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. Securities can fluctuate and when redeemed may be more or less than when originally invested. Welcome to the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Show with Josh Pick. Every week, Josh will teach you ways to help manage risk and protect your retirement income in the new economy. The primary focus at Aptus Wealth is to provide flexible planning strategies that can efficiently achieve your long-term retirement goals.
Welcome to the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Show. You can join Josh as he talks retirement every week, not only on this show, but he does so with Bruce Hooley every Monday at 12:30 p.m. on 98.9 The Answer. You can always find that recording at aptuswealth.com. And if you would like to schedule an appointment with Josh to go through the Aptus Blueprint process, Josh's phone number is 614-364-7300. That's 614-364-7300. Let's get started. Josh, home prices are soaring. Some people, I think, have PTSD from the last housing crash, and they're thinking that the same thing is going to happen this time. What role do you think that the federal government should take in this or get involved at all?
Well, that's certainly the million-dollar question. Everybody's talking about it. You know, can it continue to rise? Is it going to crash like the last time? What's going on with lumber prices? And, you know, if interest rates go up, is that going to throw it into a tailspin? And certainly, you know, interest rates are one reason why the housing market's taken off, but I would say they're pretty far from the only one. You know, I saw a stat recently, Diane, that nationally home prices have risen by over 15% in the past year. And I would say, depending upon where you live, you've seen, you know, significantly more than that potentially. But, you know, there's a cocktail of things that has to happen for home prices to go up or go down. And while interest rates is one of them, it ignores a couple of other things that are pretty important, like housing starts versus demand. So we have a historically low housing start situation going on, and COVID certainly didn't help that with lumber prices and just, you know, we had supply chain issues. So even if you want to build a house, it's difficult. I'm sure we can all think of people that have been trying to, you know, do a renovation on their home and they can't get, you know, for a while you couldn't get appliances, et cetera. So we've had our challenges that have all gone into this cocktail of shooting home prices up. But, you know, I think your question was, what should the Fed involvement be, or the government's involvement in trying to control that? Well, you know, while they can control interest rates, the other things that I mentioned, they really don't have a heck of a lot of control over. I mean, it's not like they can increase housing starts. It's not like they can fix the supply chain thing overnight. So I guess some good news, bad news. Good news is I don't think the government can do a whole heck of a lot to affect or impact the housing situation other than, you know, there is some concern over the furloughed foreclosure situation, and they do have some impact there. Interest rates, they have some impact there, but they have no impact over supply chain, and they have no impact on housing starts. But the good news, and I'm going to lean on you a little bit on this, Diane, too, because obviously this is your wheelhouse, but the people who have bought, if we want to compare and contrast to 2008, 2009, which I think is, you mentioned you had PTSD over, I think, you know, we all have a little bit of PTSD over what happened in 08, 09. Particularly people that got hurt really badly in that scenario. If you remember pre-2008, 2009, people were buying on, you know, really crazy arms. They were doing no-doc loans. People were getting way over-leveraged in their homes without putting any money down. That isn't necessarily the scenario today. Now, because of 2008, 2009, getting a mortgage, heck of a lot harder. Equity positions, a heck of a lot better. The amount of just sheer leverage that people have, a lot lower. The people who are buying these, a lot more income. So I don't think that we're setting up for necessarily the same bubble But I would also argue that I don't know that the growth pattern on what we've experienced over the last, 18 months can continue. But I don't think we're headed towards a bubble necessarily. A gradual pullback or even a lessening of growth, yes. But a bubble, no. So now I'll kick it back into your court, Diane. What do you think? What are you seeing?
I agree that there's no bubble in sight, and for the exact same reasons that you mentioned. If people were to get into trouble financially, have something catastrophic like a pandemic hit, people have enough equity in their homes that they would just sell it. And we have such a demand for properties and such a lack of supply that it would just get absorbed. So there's no concern there. And I see it just leveling off, as you say. Real estate's cyclical. We aren't going to have the rate of appreciation that we've seen the past little while. And it will increase a little bit more, but it will level off.
I agree with you. I think where we're going to see people get into problems is they will use the growth that has occurred over the last 12 to 18 months, and they will project that towards that's what's going to happen over the next 12 to 18 months, or maybe even over the next 10 years. And where I think people will get hurt is they will start buying up lots and lots of rentals and maybe get over leveraged in the amount of rentals that they hold, which is one area where people did in fact get hurt in 2008, 2009. That does not mean, by the way, that owning a home is a bad idea. It does not mean that home prices are going to crash. What it does mean is as people use this as a logic pattern to buy more and more and more and turn into landlords and get rents and get over leveraged, that's the important part of it. Doesn't mean that being a landlord or renting homes is a bad idea. I've done it myself. It's worked out to be very productive for me, and it has for many of my clients. But if you get over leveraged, meaning that you have too many mortgage payments outstanding, and then we have a rental issue where we're not getting the renters in place, well, then you can get yourself into trouble. But to say that there's a housing bubble, like you, Diane, I don't see it.
And with the rentals, the problems we had in 2008, 2009 is the vacancies. There were a lot of vacancies. Demand here is not only high for buying a house, but also for rentals, as rents are increasing as well. So we don't have that issue either. When we start getting vacancies, then you're going to have a problem with the market kind of shifting a bit and getting into trouble like that.
And I think if we kind of swing back on your original question, which was how do I think the government can get involved in protecting? Well, let's turn the table a little bit and say, how could the government get involved in ruining it? Because, they can do both. And one of the ways that they could ruin it is by making landlord provisions, rental provisions, just being able to evict somebody if they're not paying and making that impossible, that could be detrimental to landlords. But you're right, the demand, I mean, if you look at forecasted demand, we should be in good shape for the next 5 years, maybe even longer, before we kind of catch up to the amount of demand that we have already in the system.
This is the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Show with Josh Pick. I'm Diane Brennan. To schedule your own planning session to learn new strategies to manage risk, give Josh a call at 614-364-7300. That's 614-364-7300, 7300. Home prices skyrocketing. We've been talking about that, Josh. Selling a home might be one of the ways people are thinking about creating an income stream in retirement. Let's talk about some other creative ways that you find retirees can generate new income.
Well, let's talk, even though I know you want some creative ways, let's talk about the home, because I think it's overlooked a lot. We don't think of our home as a resource for income. We think of it as a great asset. And oftentimes, I think throughout history, we've heard, your home might be your greatest asset. And that's true, but very infrequently do we view that asset as a potential income generator. So let's not ignore that in today's home price environment, if you, raise some children in a home and you have a large home and you're thinking about downsizing or moving to a different part of the country, your home is a giant asset. You've certainly seen that happen here as of late. So that could be a way to generate some more resources for your retirement. The other way to use your home is through, and we've talked about this in the past, is through a HECM loan. And why would a HECM loan, or what is a HECM loan, and why would it be beneficial?
Why is it
a HECM loan? Yeah, a HECM loan is the rebranded name for the old Wild West reverse mortgage. So a HECM loan is a home equity something something acronym. But essentially what it means is now it's a regulated environment. So you can rest assured that you don't have to worry about predatory lending practices in this arena anymore. Interest rates are the lowest they've ever been in the history of the United States. It's a great time to get one of these loans. Housing prices are the highest they've been in a really long time, if not ever. So what a great time if you are in this scenario where, you know, you just really need some additional income to make retirement happen, than to use the equity in your home to generate an income stream at the lowest interest rates ever and at really, really high home prices, which are the two really moving parts that make these beneficial. So if that's something you want to learn more about, obviously reach out and we'll cover it in more detail. But know that your house is not just a stagnant asset. It doesn't mean you have to use it, but you can if necessary. But you had asked specifically, Diane, about other ways to generate income. And I would say the most popular one amongst my clients is consulting. Hopefully throughout your career, you've acquired, you know, some valuable skills in the particular occupation that you've in that you've worked in. And hopefully those are still of value to someone. And one thing that employers really, really like is eliminating some of their W-2 employees in favor of 1099. And there's a whole host of reasons, both tax and otherwise, on why they would want to do that. But that might be a great opportunity for going from a full-time job to tiering back, but not necessarily retiring and doing consulting work, particularly from home, which if there's one huge benefit that COVID's brought into play, it's the higher comfort level with employers having their employees work from home. So what a great way to, you know, I was making $60,000, $80,000, $100,000 a year, and I'm not willing to completely pack it in, but I would love to make an extra $20,000 or $30,000 a year working part-time from home. That may very well be an option. Similarly, if you have a hobby, you know, maybe you really liked, you know, tennis or golf, or you're really good at it, you've been doing it your whole life, you know, there's nothing saying that you're not allowed to turn that into a potential income stream. And there's nothing more part-time or more flexible than, you know, teaching a hobby that you're good at. So don't ignore that you've got these skills, you can consult, you can potentially do that part-time, you can teach something part-time, and then you can use your home should you need to.
And I love the fact, like, now more than ever, there's so many ways to make extra income with websites like Etsy, if you do a craft that you'd like to sell. I mean, it's just really amazing all the different opportunities.
Yeah, I've even seen, you know, the new thing is people going to, you know, even garage sales, and they know a certain thing and they'll go pick it up and turn around and sell it online for more than they paid for it, or I don't know what the term is, but
flipping.
You're right, there's just so many avenues to use the information that you have in your head and turn it into income. And make no mistake about it, I'll hear people say, well, I can only make $500 a month. Well, you just got done telling me that your retirement income goal is $4,000 a month. $500 is a pretty big percentage of the whole. So that absolutely moves the needle. That absolutely makes a big difference. Even if it's for just a few years, that can really make a monumental difference over the remainder of your life.
To schedule an appointment to go through the Aptus Blueprint process, Josh's phone number is 614-364-7300. That's 614-364-7300. And you can join Josh each week, not only by listening to this show, but he talks retirement with Bruce Hooley every Monday at 12:30 p.m. on 98.9 The Answer. You can always find the recording at aptuswealth.com. More with Josh Pick when we come back.
We'll be back with more at the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Show with Josh Pick at 98.9 The Answer.
To create a successful retirement plan in today's economy, it takes a customized, solutions-based approach. At Aptus Wealth Management, founder Josh Pick calls it the Aptus Blueprint, and it's focused on managing risk instead of chasing returns. If you're working with another advisor or simply want a second opinion, put his team to work for you. To schedule a complimentary consultation to learn more about the Aptus Blueprint process, contact Josh at 614-364-7300 or visit aptuswealth.com. There is no cost or obligation, but space is limited. To start your plan, call 614-364-7300 or visit aptuswealth.com.
Thanks for listening to the Aptus Retirement Blueprint radio show with Josh Pick. To schedule your complimentary customized planning session, give Josh a call at 614-364-7300. That's 614-364-7300.
Welcome back to the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Show with Josh Pick. Josh, CNN asked people to share the best financial advice they've ever received. But before we torch that, what is the best financial advice that you've ever received?
Well, first, I guess I got to have some give you some really boring background, but I think it's pertinent. I don't know if I'd mentioned this show yet or not, but my father passed away when I was really young. So I was 13, teenager, you know, young guy trying to figure out who he can listen to, who can give him that dad advice. And I had a lot of mentors, but my mentors were incredibly eclectic. So I was very fortunate in that my financial advice came from a wide array of backgrounds of people. So the benefit to that is I got to see people who were maybe worked for the FBI and were police officers, to construction people, to or people involved in the construction industry, to, you know, financial pros. And I got to kind of see what all of their advice was and boil it down into what I thought were pretty general guiding principles. And that was a very, you know, terrible way to get that type of eclectic background, obviously losing your dad. But at the same time, I think that was incredibly beneficial. And I'll tell you, by looking at all those people, I can't give you one piece of information that was very, very critical to me, but I can tell you some overwhelming themes. One, I saw no matter the occupation, no matter the income level, no matter the salary, people who lived within their means and did not put themselves in a position to be reliant upon the next paycheck were always happier. It didn't matter how much they made. None of that mattered. They were always happier. And people who saved early in their life and consistently saved through automating. And these were questions I was able to ask because, you know, as a fatherless kid, you can pretty much ask anybody anything because you're just looking for guidance. And people who wouldn't normally talk about that kind of stuff will tell you. People who saved early and often also seemed to be happier. Ultimately, I think, you know, the takeaway was if you save consistently and if you live well within your means, so you're not worried about your next paycheck, you will invariably be happier regardless of income level. The other thing that I learned very early on was that people who learn skills and prioritize knowledge in whatever it is they want to pursue seemed happier and had more options available to them. So it didn't matter if they were in, you know, the education field, if they were in the medical field, people who consistently tried to improve their situation through education always seemed to not only do better in life, but be happier. And that was kind of my litmus test, Diane, was how can I make myself valuable to wherever I work and happier? It was never about money for me when I started. So that was kind of the information that I was looking for. So my advice to everybody listening would be, if you can, if you're young, start early. Start, be consistent, and continue on with learning. If you're past that age period, it's never too late to start. Start saving, start getting ahead, because even if you look at that and say, well, I'm never going to reach the end zone the way I was hoping, or I'm never going to accumulate or amass this giant amount of wealth that's going to make me feel like I'm really a success, know that every step you take in that direction, I've seen it too many times, will in fact make you happier. And maybe that was a little bit of a, you know, public service, how to make a better life, but, and it's not necessarily dollars and cents, but I'm telling you, and through my job, I've been able to see people on both sides of that coin, and you will ultimately live happier regardless of your wealth. If you do those things, you will be happier. I promise.
What about those people like my dad? When I grew up, he was very, he came from another country. He didn't have a lot. And then he kind of amassed his wealth. And my dad would not let go of a penny. So where do you find that happy medium with people that aren't? Because there are some people that are happy if they feel only stress-free if they have $3 million in their bank account or $1 million in their bank account. And then there's other people that have $100,000 that you think are just as happy. Am I making any sense with?
Yeah, you totally are. Yeah, I mean, and I think this comes back to there's, in general, we know two types of people. We know the spenders and we know the savers. The savers can never save enough, and you're going to pry that money away from their white-knuckled fingers, right? And then the savers, or the spenders, oftentimes, even though they're overspending and they don't have that much money, they seem to be very happy and very carefree. So I think your original question was, how do I convince somebody like my dad who came over from another country and amassed all this money and now he won't spend a nickel? How do I change him? Well, there's two answers to that. One, some people just can't be changed. Whatever dramatic thing happened to them in childhood, maybe they saw extreme struggle. You saw this from children from the Depression. They just saw their parents struggle so much that you're never going to convince them that they don't need 10,000 rolls of toilet paper in the attic because they went without toilet paper. But the only way you have a shot at changing them is through financial planning. And the reason I say that is because some of them truly believe that it's never enough. And the only way you're going to convince them that they have enough is through education. So it's that last part of the thing that I started talking about is education, proper planning, showing that you are truly protected and quote unquote bulletproof by spending this amount of money. You're allowed. It's okay. You're not going to run the ship aground as long as you stay within these, navigational beacons, if you will.
So I take my dad to you. You can show him, look at, you're going to be just fine. You're allowed to spend this much per month.
I can't guarantee that he'll do it, but
we can try.
But it's the only shot we got.
Absolutely. What about advice that you hear that people have received when they were younger and you're like, oh my goodness, that's totally wrong. Are there some common...
Now we're getting in. There's a whole pile of those. I would say, one, don't get advice from people who have no subject matter expertise on that. And it seems like money is one of the places where we're very willing to do that. If you were going in for heart surgery, you would not take your neighbor Bob's word for it unless he was a heart surgeon. And I don't know why the poor name Bob gets picked on so much. So let's,
Karen, too.
Jim. Yeah, poor Karen. She's really had a rough go of it these last couple of years. But the point is, you would look for some sort of expertise. The other thing is, if you want to learn how to be successful, wealthy, start a business, do all these different things, go to somebody that's actually done it. Why are we listening to... Yeah, there's this guy that, he works on my car for another company, but I want to learn how to be an aerospace engineer. And he told me all the ins and outs. I got it now. You wouldn't take his advice, or at least you shouldn't take his advice. So I'm not saying ignore people or that anybody's above anybody else. There's always something to be learned from everybody. But I think oftentimes we take advice from people who are not really qualified to give that advice, and we base too much credibility on it. So that's number one. I would be very careful in who you take advice from. There's a lot of dream killers out there too, so be very cautious of them. The other thing I would say that I've seen, particularly as it relates to the stock market, and I could substantiate this with a million different studies, is people being way too emotional about investing and people trying to use maybe some experiences that they've heard people have had and somehow assign value to that. And there's in our world, there's a bunch of different terms for that. You can call it, anchoring or gambler's fallacy, or there's all these kind of names for what people do behaviorally and emotionally when investing that don't make any sense, but none of us are immune to it. That's where that pro or that expert in the field comes in to help you interpret the information that sometimes gets spilled into our brains. So I've seen people be way too emotional about investing, and that's a very difficult thing to overcome unless you have some sort of guide on that journey to help you interpret. And that kind of coincides then with being far too aggressive or far too conservative or getting in and out of the market, trying to time things too much. What's going to be the next Bitcoin tomorrow and taking, ancillary risks or, I'll give you an example. Without an appropriate guide, there's something called a gambler's fallacy. If I told you, Diane, that we were going to flip a coin 100 times, heads or tails, those are your options, right? And we have already flipped this coin 60 times, and it has been heads every time. What would you pick is going to be the next?
Heads.
Heads. So you do not subscribe to the gambler's fallacy. But most people would say tails, because it's been heads 60 times. It's got to be tails. When in reality, the 60th time is no different odds than the first time. It's still 50-50.
Right.
But we fall into these, well, it's we're due, right? And that's how, literally, if you go to a casino, that's how they're run, right? I've lost my money over and over again. I'm due. Well, not really. The odds haven't changed, but depending on the game, of course. But my point is there's a lot of just things that we have in our head that we've accrued over periods of time that don't necessarily make sense. But unless you have somebody that can help guide you through those illogical thought patterns or maybe some of the bad advice you've received, then you're kind of left to try and interpret it on your own. And if you're not dealing with it every day, that's going to be a hard road to plow.
What are some other things that you wish people didn't tell each other when it comes to this financial advice?
Well, I'll tell you some examples of some things that I've heard and how illogical they are. But if I say I'm convicted enough, I bet you I can get some people listening to agree with it. When should you collect your Social Security? Well, I talked to Bill, who I work with, and he said, take it at 62 because the government's going to run out of money. And I really like when people are really convicted, they'll throw out sometimes these laws that don't even exist. Well, I saw that there was a special notice that I got on this thing that it was notice 1-74 that said that by 2034, it's going to run out of money and the people who get in by the end of 2021 will be fine. I made all that up, by the way. And Bill probably is going to make all that up too. But he heard it from somebody else who made it all up. And if you tell it over and over again, the story gets better. And by the time it gets to you, it sounds like a very believable story. So until you actually look up all of that information, don't take it for truth and don't base your life on it. The other thing is, you know, people will be very convicted about whether or not the stock market makes sense or whether or not real estate makes sense or whether or not, you know, having debt is good or bad. And we've all heard these things. You know, I'm very debt averse. Well, there's different types of debt. You know, interest rates on debt make a big difference. And you have to make logical decisions based upon your life, not use what somebody else made as a conclusion and just run with it. So, you know, illogical decisions would be just patterning off of somebody else, totally not knowing all the variables that can impact that other person, or not knowing if they're actually telling you the truth. So in other words, if your neighbor looks like he's really killing it or she's really killing it, it might just be because they're up to their eyeballs in debt. They're really not killing it. And they're just what we call ducks, you know, very smooth on the surface. Those little feet underneath the water are moving a mile a minute. So don't base your life on trying to keep up with the Joneses. All these things are very obvious, and I know we've heard them all the time, but it's easy to get wrapped up in it, isn't it, Diane? I mean, you just start, you go, wait, hold on a second. He's having a lot of fun. I want to go do what that person's doing. Mm-hmm. You need a guide, and fortunately, that's what we do here, is we help guide our clients and make logical decisions. That does not mean we're the fun police. We're going to show you how to have the most fun possible with the resources that you have. And also, remember what I said before, the more financially secure you are, the more happy, in my experience at least, the happier people are. So we're going to try and make your life as happy as we can.
You need a plan. You need a guide. Let me give you Josh's number, the Aptus Wealth Management office number, so you can schedule your own personalized planning session. We call it the Aptus Blueprint process that you go through. Phone number is 614-364-7300. 614-364-7300. And the website is aptuswealth.com. And you can join Josh every Monday as well, besides today, Mondays at 12:30 for Money Mondays with Bruce Hooley on 98.9 The Answer. More of the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Show with Josh Pick when we come back.
We'll be back with more at the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Show with Josh Pick at 98.9 The Answer. Thanks for listening to the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Radio Show with Josh Pick. To schedule your complimentary customized planning session, give Josh a call at 614-364-7300. That's 614-364-7300.
Welcome back to the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Show with Josh Pick. We are going to talk about bonds. Josh, what role can bonds have in a portfolio during this low interest rate environment?
Well, I'll give you two answers. The first answer is not much. But the second answer is, let's talk about what logical pattern it would have. And the reason I say, let me explain the not much. So interest rates and bond prices are inversely proportional, meaning that as interest rates go up, bond prices, at least in a vacuum, go down. Now, there's other factors affecting bond prices, like demand would be one. Obviously, if interest rates go up and bond prices go down, but the demand exceeds in premium that amount, you can still make money in bonds. But that said, I would say that the deck is certainly stacked against bonds for the foreseeable future, as we're in the lowest interest rate period in history. What could be advantageous to bonds is if we had a significant pullback in the stock market, people could flock to bonds, and that could be an improved situation for bonds, potentially being a risk offset. But that said, again, I can't fathom that our interest rates are going to go much lower. It's not to say they couldn't. But we're really, really low as it is. So the long-term viability of bonds, or the short-term, by short-term, I mean, you know, next 5 to 10 years, which most people would call long term, does not look very strong for bonds. Because what are the things that could happen in bonds? Interest rates go up, bad for bonds. Interest rates remain the same. Well, that means you're going to, you know, earn a whopping, let's call it 1% in your bond portfolio. Still doesn't sound too sexy. And if interest rates go down, then you could win, but there's not too far for them to go down. But again, getting into what are some potential reasons why you'd want to go into bonds. Taxes would be one reason. You know, there are tax-exempt bonds. That has some advantages, particularly as we head into a period of for wealthy individuals, rising tax scenario, meaning income taxes and potentially capital gains rates, that may make tax-free bonds more attractive. And as they become more attractive, the demand could go up, which could create that secondary scenario that I talked about driving bond prices up. So that could be good. When we're in environments where, you know, CDs and cash rates, you know, savings rates are so low, and then you have tax-free bonds paying higher than those, again, depending upon your tax scenario, that could really go into that environment. And then just pure safety. Bonds are a heck of a lot more safe, quote-unquote, in the way of volatility, at least, than the stock market. So they still play their part in safety. Now, I would argue that there are other alternative investments that could be utilized outside of bonds that tend to look a little bit more favorable, in my opinion. Some of those, but not limited to the ones that I'm just going to mention now, would be things like fixed annuities. Why would I say fixed annuities look beneficial today? Well, they're paying about three times or more that than the interest rate of bonds. And you also have one little addition, and that is if interest rates go the wrong direction, you have a principal guarantee attached to a fixed annuity, meaning you can't lose any money, which is absolutely possible in bonds. Matter of fact, if you look over the last, depending on what time period you look over the last 12 months, bonds have in fact been negative. So you get a better rate of return with the guaranteed safety element of not losing any money in a negative interest rate environment. So I would argue that fixed annuities are a better alternative to bonds right now. I would not have argued that 20 years ago, but right now, I think that is the case. So there are alternatives to bonds, but the advantage to those alternatives and bonds is safety and, at least for the most part, volatility limiting. And in the case of fixed annuities, you know, the elimination of risk in its entirety.
And you check with your clients their portfolios at least twice a year. So those are some of the things that you go over and go through and tweak and change if necessary.
Of course, I would say that, you know, by and large, we're long-term investors here. That does not mean that we're buy and hold, but it also does not mean that we're day traders. But we do believe in rebalancing and taking advantage of situations and limiting volatility to the specifications of what our clients are looking for. So can we put restrictions and limits on volatility, the amount of bounce, the amount of loss that you can experience in a short period of time? Absolutely. And are there times in your life, for example, as you get closer and closer to that red zone of retirement, where we want to tier back risk to make returns a little more predictable? Of course. And we're always looking at that at least several times a year.
You're listening to the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Show with Josh Pick. To schedule your own planning session, to learn new strategies to manage risk, or if you have questions about the show, you can give Josh a call at 614-364-7300. That's 614-364-7300. Let's switch to talking about sequence of withdrawals. Josh, there are good rules of thumb when it comes to that, but what are some situations where one might throw those rules out?
Well, for sequence withdrawals, what Diane is mentioning here, I believe, and just to clarify, is which assets we should take income from first. And by assets, I don't necessarily mean what investments they're in, but I mean what tax qualification they're in. So for example, 401ks, IRAs, all that alphabet soup is taxed one way. Non-qualified dollars, or and by that I mean just money you saved after you paid taxes on it that might be in a brokerage account or an annuity like we had mentioned before, that's taxed a different way. And then Roth IRAs are taxed even differently, and you know, rental income is taxed even differently. But in general, if you look at any financial planning software, you know, kind of right out of the box, or you look at a financial planning handbook of where should I take my money first, it's always going to say the same thing. And that is required minimum distributions first because, well, they're required, so we have to take them. So we might as well start there. Required minimum distributions are not a factor until you're 72, at least by current tax law. And at 72, you are required to take a certain amount of money out of your qualified plans, which is 401ks, IRAs, et cetera. So that's always the first start. You got to take the money from there first if that applies to you. After that, you go to your taxable accounts next, which is what we call non-qualified accounts, meaning your non-IRAs, non-401ks, non-Roth IRAs, all that other stuff. You go there first. Then you move on to these traditional qualified accounts like the IRAs, 401ks, et cetera. And then last, you go to your Roth IRAs. I would argue that that is completely and utterly nonsense in most scenarios. And you would say, well, you know, if all these Academy of Smart people and professors and all these different people have written all these books, why in the world are you telling me it's the wrong idea? I'm not telling you it's wrong conceptually, but in practicality, many times it's wrong. And I'll throw just a couple kinks in the armor of this argument, and you'll see what I mean. Let's say that you're living on Social Security, and you wanted to, that's all the money you have. You're a married couple, you're living on Social Security, and let's say that that Social Security is $4,000 a month. If you take an additional $20,000 out a year from your Roth IRA, you pay no taxes on it. If you take it out from your taxable account, you pay no taxes on it. If you take it out from your traditional IRA account, you will pay no taxes on it because your standard deduction is greater than the amount of money that you're actually being taxed on. So your taxable income is still zero in all those scenarios. So knowing that, if I was going to take money from somewhere and I knew it was going to be tax-free regardless, why wouldn't I take it from the category that's going to be potentially most taxed if our tax code changes? So I would argue that we would want to take it from our traditional IRA because that is the least tax-advantaged account of the ones that I just suggested. Even though conventional wisdom would say take from that second, in this particular scenario, I would argue that you should take from that first, because the outcome is the same, but the flexibility down the line is significantly different. There also could be instances where you're trying to improve your situation down the line. Like, for example, I'd like to do Roth IRA conversions so that I never have to pay taxes on this money, regardless of what tax code is at that time. But in order to do that, I might have to shift around where I take my other normal income that I want to live off of so that I can maximize the amount of Roth IRA conversion. So the point here is, like, you know, I sound like a broken record oftentimes, these principles are great in learning the logic pattern behind why you would want to do something and not want to do something, and also learning what these different things even are. So it's great that, you know, for you to learn the general guidelines of the withdrawals, that means you at least have to understand what these categories are. So that's a great learning benchmark. But in practicality, it might not make any sense at all in your particular situation. I'm sure everybody has their own profession that's listening to this right now, and you can think of an instance in your profession where there are general guidelines that everybody goes by, and then depending upon where you are in your career, you sit back and go, well, yeah, that works, like, you know, as a general guideline, but I can think of 15 examples why we could do it better a different way. It's no different in my world. So great guideline, many scenarios where you wouldn't want to actually use that guideline.
I can't imagine anyone trying to figure this out themselves.
Well, I mean, I can't imagine anybody taking the engine out of my car and putting it back in, because I would just end up with 47 extra bolts in a car that wouldn't start. Mm-hmm. But certain people really like that, and I'm glad that those people are there, because if you ever see me on the side of the road with the hood of my truck up, it's just because I'm trying to block the sun while AAA is on its way, because I have no idea what I'm looking at. And similarly, that person that's going to come to fix my truck, this might not be his wheelhouse. It just happens to be mine. So we're happy to help, just like I'm really glad that, you know, mechanics are happy to help me.
When people call your office, Josh, you take them through the Aptus Blueprint process. Can you go over that and explain to our new listeners that are just tuning in what that is?
Yeah, so it's a diagnostic process, but it's also a great opportunity for us to find out if we're a good fit. You know, is our type of planning, our core competency, and also the way that we deliver information the right fit for you, and are you the right fit for us? And we made that into a pretty encompassing process so we can make logical decisions on both sides. This is going to be a long-term relationship, so we better know before we decide to move forward that it's a good fit. So step one, it's the get-to-know-you meeting. We call it the discovery meeting. We're going to find out everything that you want to accomplish and everything that you're currently doing and have done up to this point to help accomplish those objectives. So this is the info gathering meeting on both sides of the table. Feel free to ask us any questions about us and how we do things and our background, etc. Meeting number two is the analysis meeting. So we're going to show you, based upon what you told us you want to accomplish and what you're doing currently, how much risk are you taking, and is the arrow going to hit the target, and what are some speed bumps that could get in the way of that that roadmap. Meeting number three, we call it our blueprint meeting, and it's specifically called a blueprint and not a plan, because we will give you actionable items that you can do to fill all the gaps that we may have uncovered along the way. How do we lessen the impact of taxes? How do we make sure that market volatility isn't going to derail our plan, et cetera, et cetera? And then not until meeting number four, or at least at the end of meeting number three, will we decide, is this a mutually beneficial fit? And do we want to go into meeting number four, which is the implementation process, which is the necessary paperwork, et cetera.
Josh's number to schedule the Aptus Blueprint process with him is 614-364-7300, 614-364-7300. More with Josh Pick when we come back. You're listening to the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Show.
We'll be back with more at the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Show with Josh Pick at 98.9 The Answer.
To create a successful retirement plan in today's economy, it takes a customized, solutions-based approach. At Aptus Wealth Management, founder Josh Pick calls it the Aptus Blueprint, and it's focused on managing risk instead of chasing returns. If you're working with another advisor or simply want a second opinion, put his team to work for you. To schedule a complimentary consultation to learn more about the Aptus Blueprint process, contact Josh at 614-364-7300 or visit aptuswealth.com. There is no cost or obligation, but space is limited. To start your plan, call 614-364-7300 or visit aptuswealth.com.
Thanks for listening to the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Radio Show with Josh Pick. To schedule your complimentary customized planning session, give Josh a call at 614-364-7300. That's 614-364-7300.
Welcome back to the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Show with Josh Pick. Josh, I heard that President Biden has been urged to create a retirement security task force. What would something like this look like? And do you feel it's even necessary?
Well, I think that, you know, the buzzword of today is we need a task force for everything, right? It seems like we have a task force for everything. But, you know, what would a retirement security task force do? I think in general, the reason for this is the Bipartisan Policy Center recently sent President Biden a letter that said, we really urge you to create a retirement security task force. Furthermore, it was signed by 31 kind of household names in the financial industry. So think of the big names in the financial industry gain the support, which is not shocking. And I believe, if I recall correctly from reading it, that the aim was to kind of examine solutions to the common retirement problems and risks, shortfalls, savings rates. Low interest rates have a huge impact on, you know, retirees today because their risk-free rate of return is really low. Soaring costs of health care, long-term care, all the challenges that somebody that's looking at retirement today faces. They did not make mention, by the way, of the potential loss of Social Security or the problems that Social Security is facing. But do I think it'll make a difference? Not really, to be honest. But if it does provide additional education, then I support it. But I think it'll bring about as much help to the retiree as creating a task force for more logical choices of eating would bring to the average person in America. I mean, we're going to eat what we're going to eat. We're going to save what we're going to save. And in the United States, we don't like being forced to do anything. So I don't think they'll ever force the savings. I don't think they'll ever force the education. So it's really left to the populace. It's left to us to take control of our own situation. I do not believe the task force will help in that, but hopefully I am pleasantly surprised and very, very wrong. You know, the things that they're mentioning is information that's available to everybody already. You just have to take the proactive approach to go learn it. And there's two ways that you can take that proactive approach to learn it. You can either try and do it yourself, which I think, Diane, you've said about 175 times, you can't imagine trying. But there are many people who are do-it-yourselfers in every category, and you're more than welcome to do that. And fortunately for you, there is plenty of information out in the, you know, on the web to be able to make a very good financial plan if you're willing to put in the time and also the discipline and also have some method of accountability to follow through on that. Also make sure that in a timely fashion you review it and do all the things you're supposed to do. The other method is meet with a professional. And there's plenty of us out there. Get an education lesson very, very quickly. I don't know how a security retirement security task force improves that. But again, hopefully I'm very, very wrong. And it is a very beneficial scenario. But I think it will probably end up just being an additional use of tax dollars, unfortunately. And I apologize for being so pessimistic on this one. But I haven't seen too many task force scenarios come out with hugely positive results. And I don't think this is probably going
to
be one.
And the only positive, I guess, is bringing it to the forefront in the media about the need to for everyone to think about retirement, I guess, if we're looking for a glimmer of positivity in it.
Sure, sure. I mean, if we can shine a light on the fact that people need to be proactive about taking control of their financial lives and their retirement, then I'm all for it. If we can bring it to the forefront of putting out great information and the media grabbing a hold of it, that would be great. Unfortunately, I don't think, you know, the media has not shown me, unfortunately, that the concept of, hey, here's some positive information everybody can take away and really do well with their lives doesn't really seem to be media worthy these days. It has to be something much more shock value than that. So I don't know how much airtime it'll really get, Diane. And again, I know I like to be a very optimistic person, and hopefully I convey that on a regular basis. But in this particular one, I'm not too optimistic, but I hope I'm wrong.
And what kind of chunk of change are we talking about when it comes to tax dollars for this security task force? Have you guys seen any numbers?
I have not.
Meaning I'm talking to Mike, our producer, as well.
Right. No, I have not. But typical would be way more than you would probably assume. But again, there's no magic bullets with any of this. You know, the potential solutions are always going to involve making tough decisions. You know, how much time do you want to devote to it? Learning about haves and have nots and all the financial education that we're trying to impart on people through the show. And this show is not causing anybody any tax dollars. So I think that private industry has a very good method in place to already attack that. But if we can impart financial literacy, particularly in areas that are underserved and in socioeconomic statuses that are underserved, then by all means, I am incredibly supportive of that. And I hope that the government does a fantastic job. And I hope that that task force makes a difference.
Everybody's concerned about Social Security and all this talk and the media saying we're going to run out of Social Security. How much of a cut to Social Security benefits can we realistically expect based on everyone's age as we look years ahead?
Well, first, let's get the lay of the land. So we've talked about this a lot, and stats seem to be kind of ever evolving and coming out. But at the end of the day, sometime after 2030, I've seen stats as high as 2034, I've seen it as low as 2030, Social Security is quote unquote going to run out of money. And what does that mean? That does not mean that your Social Security is going to go away. It's funded in two ways. Way number one, people are paying into Social Security, and that money is going right back out the door to people who are collecting Social Security. So everybody that's listening to this, working and paying into Social Security, you're paying in and you are funding people who are retired. Now, it used to be that that was more than enough. So all of us working were paying in, and that was more than enough to cover the people who were collecting, and we're actually building up a surplus. Think of it as like a trust fund. Well, that the tables have turned over the years, and now we're not paying in enough for the people that are collecting, and that trust fund is going to run out of money somewhere between 2030 and 2034. And what would that mean? That would mean that roughly a quarter, and again, I've seen different stats as much as, you know, 20% or as low as 20%, as high as 26%. Let's just say roughly a quarter of everybody's Social Security benefits, if there were no changes made, would go away. So that does not mean that you would get no Social Security. What it does mean is you would get about 75% of your Social Security payments. Now, I'm not saying that to make people panic, because I don't think that there's any expert on the planet that believes that Congress will allow a significant cut to Social Security beneficiaries. I just don't see it happening. However, I do believe that in 2030 to 2034, Congress is going to be faced with a difficult decision. And that is, what do we do? And there's several ways that they can fix it, or a blend of several ways. One would be extending the collection age, meaning it used to be, if you were 66 or 67, depending upon when you were born, that was your full retirement age. They could extend that and say, for people who are currently 20, your full retirement age isn't until 70 or 72. I have no idea what that number is going to be, but they would have to extend it. Number two would be increase payroll taxes, meaning we all pay in a certain percentage of our pay into Social Security. Let's raise that percentage up to help fund the gap. There are other ways, obviously, lower the benefit amount, you know, elimination of some spousal benefits. There's a whole bunch of, none of these I'm agreeing with, and they're all bad, by the way. But there's going to be some difficult decisions that have to be made in 2030 or 2034. I think they will be made, but I don't think they'll be made until about 2030 or 2034, because what politician wants to jump on that grenade early? I think that they will wait until their hand is forced. But you asked me a very specific question, and I give you a very long-winded explanation of the problem. Let me give you the answer that you're looking for. And that is, if I was planning for years ahead, what would I plan for? Well, I think, you know, good news, if you're a baby boomer, I think you're on target. I don't think you need to make any adjustments. I don't think your Social Security is going to be drastically impacted. I think you're too close. You'll be caught in the grandfathering process of whatever process they come up with. I think Gen Xers, you know, like me, if I was going to plan on Social Security, I would say let's plan on a 10% reduction. Now, that 10% reduction could be because my collection age is later, could be because my payment amount is less, but let's just bank on about a 10% reduction. I think that's reasonably fair. If you wanted to be more conservative, obviously you could drop it back a little bit more than that, but I think that that's a fair assumption. I think, you know, once we get past that Gen Xer, and remember, Gen Xers, I think in general that means you were born before 1980, I believe, as a Gen Xer. But I think once you get earlier than that, meaning that you were born after 1980, I think it's a little too early to tell. I don't know how you bank on that. I think the best case scenario is maybe the time frame just gets a little longer, or I don't know. So unfortunately, if you come into my office and you say, what if you're born after 1980, that makes you, you know, let's just say under the age of 40, I think it's very, very difficult to see what the impact would be. In my office, we tend to stress test it at about 25% off the mark for people in that category. But that's just that. It's just a guess. It's too early to tell. But as we draw closer and we get closer and closer to that retirement red line for those folks, I think we'll have a much better explanation. I think the short answer is make sure you're saving on target, make sure that your allocations are appropriate, and make sure that you have a buffer zone in the event of. But the benefit for those people is you have a lot of time, and time is your biggest asset. So the real people that I think are left to tussle with the decision is probably the Gen Xers more than the other categories.
Of course. Did I sound bitter there? But
we're in the same category, so I'm with you.
I guess the message is for, you know, after Gen X is maybe don't count on it and just act. I mean, it'll be there maybe in a lesser amount, but you have the time to be able to save now to kind of make up for any kind of fluctuation.
Yeah, you know, I think sometimes I agree with you, but I think sometimes that can be very disheartening because while the easy answer is we'll just save more, that's not always in the cards for everyone. And that can be very discouraging to say, well, wait a second, you mean to tell me I'm going to save 10 or 15% of my income and there's still a significant likelihood that I'm not going to be able to retire because of Social Security? Or I'm doing the best I can, but if Social Security is not there, I'm going to have to work for the rest of my life. I think, you know, significantly reducing is probably reasonable, but the elimination can make sometimes the retirement planning process or the retirement planning analysis just looks so grim that I don't think it's truly fair, but two, it can just be so disheartening that you almost want to throw your hands up in the air and walk away. So let's stress test it significantly, but maybe not the entire elimination of it, unless you're in a position to be able to really accommodate for that.
Thanks, everyone, so much for joining us. This has been the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Show with Josh Pick. And you can always join Josh again this week as he talks retirement with Bruce Hooley every Monday at 12:30 p.m. on 98.9 The Answer. You can always find that recording at aptuswealth.com. And of course, if you'd like to schedule an appointment to go through the Aptus Blueprint process, Josh's phone number is 614-364-7300. That is 614-364-7300. Josh's website is aptuswealth.com, spelled W-E-A-L-T-H, aptuswealth.com. Thanks so much for joining us.
You've been listening to the Aptus Retirement Blueprint Radio Show with host Josh Pick. Josh helps guide his clients through retirement by managing risk instead of chasing returns. He calls it a blueprint, and you can get started at no cost or obligation. Give the team at Aptus Wealth a call today to schedule your consultation at 614-364-7300. That's 614-364-7300 or online at aptuswealth.com. That's aptuswealth.com. To learn strategies to manage risk in the new economy, join us again next weekend right here at 98.9 The Answer. Any comments regarding safe and secure investments and guaranteed income streams refer only to fixed insurance products. They do not refer in any way to securities or investment advisory products. Fixed insurance and annuity product guarantees are subject to the claims paying ability of the issuing company.